Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, May 8th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI's Sam Houghton and Jeanette Barnes, Rich Salzberg at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, Jack Spillane at the Standard Times, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll check in with Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from Mike Dean up at the State House, and we'll finish off by speaking with WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. WCAI Sam Houghton bats leadoff in this busy time with an overview of the latest numbers and information on the local coronavirus response. Good morning, Sam.
Morning, Steve.
Sam, we keep hearing about a surge, a plateau. What did the numbers tell us this week?
Yeah, it's been an interesting week. At first, it seemed like numbers were starting to slow down. But then from Wednesday on, we've seen the numbers kind of shoot back up again. It seems like we're still in this kind of plateau stage, at least on a state level. At the same time, some hospitals have not exceeded their capacity, as some models had predicted. Cape Cod Healthcare was confident enough to close a field hospital set up at Joint Base Cape Cod. We learned that yesterday. That facility never had one patient. Kind of interesting there. Still, 4,500 people have died in the state. That's up 1,000 from last Friday. We surpassed Michigan this week to become the state with the third highest death toll in the country. There are about 74,000 cases in total around the state. That's up about 12,000 from last Friday. And then locally, kind of a sobering milestone for the Cape. More than 1,000 residents have now tested positive. That's in total. And then Bristol and Plymouth County are still showing high numbers, about 4,500 total in Bristol and a little over 6,000 in Plymouth. Still low numbers on the islands, though. No new cases on Nantucket for a fourth day in a row. And then Vineyard Gazette, they reported one new case on the Vineyard yesterday.
Sam, this pandemic has made some town clerks nervous about a special state election scheduled in less than 2 weeks. It's a race to fill a vacant seat on the state Senate in Plymouth and the Upper Cape. Is this election going to take place?
Yeah, well, as far as we know, it's going to be held May 19th. But the news this week, Plymouth selectmen sent a letter to the state legislature asking that the election be pushed back again. This will be the second time it's been delayed because of the pandemic. The seat has been vacant for a year and a half since Vinny DiMacedo resigned in November. On the other hand, though, town clerk Michael Palmer in Falmouth, he's confident going forward in the election. He said they've had requests for about 12% of the electorate for mail-in ballots. Really, all town clerks in the district are pushing for people to vote by mail. But I think important to this, Plymouth has a much higher infection rate, as we were talking about before, than Barnstable County. So you can see hesitation by the Plymouth selectmen. And we've heard from, we haven't yet heard from the state legislature, but it'll be interesting to see how they handle this. You can probably remember the long lines in the rain last month for people waiting to vote in Wisconsin. We even heard reports that people got sick from voting there. So I think this will be interesting.
It seemed like this was the week that momentum has been building for reopening. There was a protest in Boston, new groups coming together to plan reopenings. And then Governor Baker yesterday allowed golf.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting. He's basically making an exception to his emergency order expiring in just about 10 days. There's some guidelines for golfers. There won't be carts. Clubhouses won't be open. He's basically saying that courses and golfers can maintain social distancing. It can be allowed. Also, kind of interesting, gun shops have been allowed to open. That's because of a federal court ruling yesterday, same day that golf was allowed, actually. Baker had qualified them as non-essential in his original order, so they've been closed during the pandemic, but some gun advocates took the administration to court, and they won a key ruling yesterday. We don't know if there's going to be any appeal, but as of now, gun stores can open this weekend.
That is WCAI Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Cape Cod Healthcare announced it is furloughing about 600 workers. WCAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us to talk about that and other coronavirus news. Hi, Jeanette.
Good morning, Steve.
600 workers, a lot of jobs here. What does Cape Cod Healthcare say about this move? What brought it about, and who's getting furloughed?
Right. Well, essentially, they said they've been trying to hold out as long as they could these last 2 months, keeping people fully employed, keeping them on the payroll, even if they couldn't work their full hours because they just can't do any of those elective surgeries and really a whole host of other non-urgent things that the whole system does, from in-person doctor's visits to everything else. And they said their projected revenue loss is $74 million, which is 41%. And he said they can't afford to keep people on anymore. They are going to still be employees, right? They're not being laid off. They are being furloughed, so they hope to bring them back in a month. But it's hard to see exactly how much they can recover financially in that space of time.
Another big story you reported on this week, Cape and Islands legislators and community leaders have created a task force to guide the reopening of the region once state restrictions are lifted. Tell us a little bit about this task force. Who's on it, and what is the goal here?
Well, so it's a big list, and they're meeting virtually, at least for the time being, which is good because they need a really big room. But they have the full State House delegation. They have several town administrators, select board members, people from Cape Cod Healthcare, from the business community, a labor representative, and so forth. The goal they're saying, and Senator Julian Cyr said this yesterday, he's kind of the spokesman for the group. He says it's to have a safe and structured reopening of the Cape, both for business purposes and social purposes. So when they say safe and structured, they're saying this is going to be in compliance with the state. They're not making any kind of effort to sort of push beyond what Governor Baker or the Department of Public Health are doing, but they want the communities to be ready to go whenever, whenever any particular guideline gets relaxed. They want the Cape and Islands to be all set to go. Another thing they talked about was having a really consistent message that they can communicate for now to property owners and then later to visitors who might be coming to the Cape. They want to be able to be clear about what's allowed, what's not, things like what's happening at the beaches, which of course is a really hot issue right now. What's the parking going to be like? What's the social distancing going to be like?
As if we didn't know it already, the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce had some strong numbers to report this week about local business activity. Tell us what they said.
Right. Wendy Northcross tells us that business activity on Cape Cod is down 90 to 95% compared to last year. So they're doing essentially 0 to 10% of their business. She says that no sector has gone untouched. And of course, people are aware of this, the whole idea that even as our focus now is on tourism and travel for the summer season, that the money that comes into the hospitality industry on the Cape and Islands cycles through the whole economy throughout the year. And so she gave the example of a car dealer who sells a car. It's not hospitality related, but they're selling that car to someone who earns their living from vacationers or from serving the summer population. So yeah, she says even as other businesses open, this is going to continue to be an issue.
We're out of time, but I want to make a quick mention, Jeanette, of a story that you reported this week that was not COVID related. And folks can go to our website and check it out. It's on geriatric animals at the Buttonwood Park Zoo. It was a really sweet story about how they're taking care of aging animals at the Buttonwood Park Zoo. Jeanette Barnes from WCAI, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks very much, Steve.
The Steamship Authority has some dismal ridership numbers for April, and if things don't improve drastically, the ferry line is projecting a staggering deficit. Reporter Rich Salzberg from the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with the story. Hi, Rich.
Hi, good morning, Steve.
Rich, describe for us just how bad the month of April was for the Steamship Authority.
Well, Steve, they were down across the board, unfortunately. Ridership has taken a hit from the pandemic, and that was expressed in the numbers. Trucks were down, automobiles were down, and passengers were down. About 25,000 automobiles less than last year, and about 40% less truck traffic than last year. All in all, the knock-on effect for the Steamship Authority is pretty significant because they get all their income from the fare box. They don't have any funding from the Commonwealth. So if they don't make it on the vessels, they don't make it at all. So just 1 month's hit can be significant. And they've used those figures a little bit to try to project what's coming, and it's been hard for them. But Bob Davis at the most recent meeting told his board that if things don't change, if the numbers don't go up, and if they don't get outside capital, they're looking at a $60 million loss, which is roughly half their annual income.
$60 million is a big figure. What happens if it approaches something like that? Who's on the hook for that?
Well, that's an interesting question. Statutorily, at the end of the year, the Steamship Authority is able to ask the state treasurer to bail it out. And in turn, if the state treasurer does that, it will assess the five port communities for whatever amount of money that is. And it could be in the tens of millions. That doesn't necessarily mean it will be or will happen. But if it does, the percentages break down for 35% to Nantucket, 35% to the Vineyard, 10% to Falmouth, 10% to New Bedford, and 10% to Barnstable.
Let me ask you about how they're coping in the short term, because a lot of this is still so uncertain what the summer is going to look like and what ridership numbers may eventually end up at. But between now and as we head into the summer, how are they operating with such a deficit?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, they've pared down service, and they've and they're soldiering on as far as like we all are in the pandemic, by wearing masks, by trying to apply social distancing on the vessels at the terminals. But I think the most evident effect is less vessels. And less vessels for them mean less income. They make all their income on passengers, not on the vehicles that are on their boats. And in addition to less people making reservations in general, if you run less boats, you have less people paying you, and you have less fare box revenue.
And they have a line of credit that they've just managed to get set up. Is that right?
It's true. The Martha's Vineyard Bank afforded them a $10 million line of credit. It's unclear where that's going to be allocated. Money is compartmentalized in the Steamship Authority into different funds by statute. It isn't easily shifted from fund to fund, especially in regards to their operating fund, which is what makes the boats go. And that operating fund can only have a limited amount of money in it based on the budget, which is set every autumn. It can only have the current month and the next month's budgeted amount of money in it. So the $10 million from the bank may not necessarily be able to go into that fund. It wasn't made clear by Mr. Davis at the last meeting where he will allocate that sum, but they were keen on getting it.
That is Rich Salzberg from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Rich, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. The Family Pantry in Harwich is reporting a 97% increase in new client visits. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us now with the story. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm well. Tim, that's a massive uptick, but it sounds like the food pantry is meeting that challenge head on.
Yeah, Christine Menard, who's the director there, told us that most of this increase is new clients, individuals and families who have lost jobs and need help putting on food on the table. Some of those people are ones that who would be usually starting seasonal jobs, but the businesses where they usually be working aren't open. But as you said, they're being able to keep up at this point. There's a waiting list of volunteers. They've got plenty of help, and the Greater Boston Food Bank, which provides most of their food, has doubled its operation. And she said, while the variety of foods may be slightly less than they've been able to provide in the past, they still have a basic selection for folks, including meat and vegetables. Although, again, they say they've got about 20 different varieties of vegetables instead of the usual 30 or more. And they've had plenty of donations coming in to help. They received recently more than $215,000 in a challenge grant to buy some new vehicles to help with their Healthy Meals in Motion mobile pantry program, which distributes food to seniors centers in Dennis, Chatham, Brewster, Eastham, and Provincetown, and they're going to be able to add Orleans to that soon. And Menard says she has no idea how long this is going to keep up, but she said they're prepared to continue all day, every day, until the need's not there anymore.
One of the things they say is that they've had, like so many places, they've had to change how they do business now, but they've managed to do that in order to continue to serve people.
Yeah, they've set up a sort of drop and pickup system where people drive in and they provide a list of a sort of a shopping list. The volunteers gather that food and bring it back out to them. And they said, Christine said, some of the people who've come to them say they feel very safe there. They feel safer than going to grocery stores because of the precautions that they've taken and the system they've set up.
Tim, you've also got an update on the Chatham Senior Center. The Select Board has heard the results of a feasibility study for an alternate site. This is a story we've been talking about for a long time, on and off. And now the board says it wants to stay with its first choice. Is that right?
That's correct. This week, the board voted to not support a proposal for a senior center on land on Stepping Stones Road. And they have endorsed the alternate or the original proposal, which was to build the center on land at 1610 Main Street in West Chatham. This week, they heard a report from a study group that had been looking at both sites, and they had most recently done a $75,000 feasibility study of the Stepping Stones Road property. And owner project manager Rick Pomeroy said a senior center at that location would actually cost more, about $240,000 more than a comparable building in West Chatham, because of the need to clear and level the site, which is adjacent to Monomoy Regional Middle School. There are other drawbacks that selectmen saw, including the location in a residential district. Town council told them because the land was originally acquired by the town to build a school, change of use would have to be approved, again, by the selectmen, who really don't favor it. And the Monomoy School Committee, which currently controls the property, has declined to release it so far. So selectmen don't see any advantage to this site. Supporters of the site, though, say that they still believe it's the better location. And because their proposal was submitted by petition, it will go on the warrant for the June 22nd town meeting. Both proposals will be on that warrant, although selectmen have said that they intend to defer that vote until the fall in order to keep the annual town meeting warrant as lean as possible. Mm.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Provincetown restaurants have been experimenting with serving takeout under the new health guidelines and thinking a lot about the summer ahead. From the Provincetown Banner, we're joined now by Marianne Bragg with the story. Hi, Marianne.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm doing well. You spoke to a number of restaurant owners and workers about how it's going so far, trying to be open in this moment. Tell us about what you heard.
It's definitely a mixed bag. Right now, there's about 20 restaurants and food stores that are open. All of them are operating under either takeout, pickup or takeout or delivery. And, generally what they found is that people who are coming, to get food or ordering food are doing pretty well in terms of the requirements with face masks and kind of all of that. But at the same time, the people who are working, who are own the businesses, are really kind of expressing a real concern about what the summer is going to be like. So that's really, I think they're looking to Governor Baker in terms of the determination about non-essential businesses and what's next. So it's a big concern, I think, right now.
It must be difficult for these restaurants because they're dealing with so much uncertainty. I mean, there's just really no sense of what the requirements are going to be for the summer or how to accommodate any kind of sit-down seating or something like that, right?
I think so. I mean, there really is so much uncertainty. And I guess one of the things I thought was interesting and was the Provincetown Business Guild, Bob Sanborn, talked about how that uncertainty, I mean, we have state laws, and then now the town has also kind of added its own, I guess, more tight restrictions on face masks. But it's difficult for visitors, people who aren't really reading the newspaper every single day, to kind of know how to act and what might sometimes be perceived as really bad, maybe non-compliant behavior is really, hopefully could be improved when the situation kind of settles down in terms of what's expected of the public, and then when people become more educated about that.
Tell us about the Pride event for Provincetown. That is kind of, it's not going to happen officially, but some
right.
businesses are still sort of have it in their sights. What does that mean?
Well, let's see. So the Business Guild, they announced way back when everything seemed kind of normal, that they have four major events this year planned. And the Pride event is probably one of the smaller ones, but it's the first one that they had planned. It's in like the first weekend in June is supposed to be. And usually maybe 2,000 to 3,000 people would come to town for that. So the Business Guild decided that they're not going to be, they'd given themselves like 30 day window to try to decide. So now that they're up against that, they've decided that the event is not going to happen, but they are trying, kind of part of their marketing is to present a more softer kind of invitation to please come back whenever you can. And so, you know, whenever the coronavirus concerns settle down. So they're asking business owners to try to have like Pride themes maybe on their online stores, or even like for takeout, you know, food for restaurants, to have some kind of a Pride offering. So more of kind of a softer, gentler selling advertising, I would say. So that's kind of what they're planning.
That is Marianne Bragg from the Provincetown Banner. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good one.
Nursing homes have been particularly vulnerable to the coronavirus, and a pair of those on the South Coast have been no exception. Jack Spillane of the Standard Times in New Bedford is with us now. Hi, Jack.
Hi, how are you today, Steve?
Jack, tell us about these two nursing homes and how they're handling this. This is Brandon Woods in Dartmouth and Sacred Heart in New Bedford.
Well, I'll start with Brandon Woods. Brandon Woods has had a particularly difficult time just since we wrote that story on Sunday. At that time, they had 9 patients who have died. Now they have 16 who have died. At their height, they had 69 patients who had tested positive, and another 21 staff members who had tested positive. It's interesting because Brandon Woods also runs a nursing home in New Bedford. Dartmouth is a suburb of New Bedford, and in that nursing home, there were 0 cases. It's a little bit smaller than the other one, but it just goes to show how it's very difficult to control these outbreaks once they get in a nursing home, and this facility has had an awful time of it.
And not only the residents there, but the staff too.
Yes, some of the staff members early on were upset because initially Brandon Woods was following what they said were their CDC recommendations not to recommend masks, and some of the workers had wanted to wear them. And then, of course, when the CDC changed their recommendation, there was some criticism that they could have prevented it if they had been allowed to wear them earlier. It was very interesting to watch, Brandon, was the paper reported on this facility when they had just one case. And within 2 days, it had blown to five cases. And from there, it just went on. And the CEO talked about it being very difficult because you have to have people coming in every day to care for the residents. And you don't know, even though they had banned visitors, you don't know who was coming in every day. And early on, they weren't doing testing, although I guess now they've tested all their both residents and employees. And this is a facility that was running a whole separate wing just for COVID-19 cases, and they still were not able to get a handle on it.
Let me ask you to sort of step back even a little bit and talk about what the feeling is like right now in New Bedford and the region there. The numbers keep going up. What is the feeling?
So the feeling is that New Bedford may be a little bit behind the metropolitan areas of Boston and Providence. The cases have not begun to decline here. Some evidence they may have plateaued. New Bedford right now has 800 plus cases of coronavirus. Dartmouth, which is a big town of 35,000, has about 200. And then on from there to the throughout the South Coast. The mayor this week instituted strict safety standards for New Bedford's factories when they come back online. That and the seafood industry processing plants will have to have spacing between workers that maybe traditionally did not have so much space, and people will be wearing masks. But there is a feeling in the city that we haven't gotten to the peak yet in New Bedford, that we might be just a little bit behind some of the other nearby areas.
Jack Spillane of the Standard Times in New Bedford. Jack, thanks for joining us this morning.
Nice talking to you, Stu.
The lodging associations of Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard this week sent a letter warning of the consequences if they're not allowed to reopen. Josh Balling joins us now from the Inquirer and Mirror. Hiya, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, it sounds like a lot of frustration and concern here about what tourism means to the island economy and where this may be heading if they're not allowed to reopen soon.
It certainly does. Tourism and the hospitality industry, obviously one of the main economic drivers of life on the Cape and Islands, and Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard in particular. And to put it into some context, in 2018, the last year that numbers were available, visitors to Nantucket spent $208 million on the island, and the local lodging and restaurant industries combined to provide more than 1,200 jobs and over $14 million in state and local tax revenue. And that was undoubtedly more last year, but those numbers haven't been compiled yet. That revenue obviously is in jeopardy this year as the coronavirus pandemic, by necessity and by order, has been keeping people off the islands for the last several months. And lodging associations, lodging owners are also worried that even when those orders are lifted and advisories are lifted, that people may be hesitant to come back to the islands. So they are asking the Governor's Advisory Council for some help, for some guidance in basically, you know, when can they reopen? When will some of these advisories and the short-term rental bans be lifted so they can reopen? They warn of, you know, basically economic disaster if it doesn't happen. Those are pretty strong numbers that contribute to the island's economies, and they also, you know, ancillarily contribute to the building trades, which may be about the same, if not more, of an economic driver on the islands. You know, the state obviously has banned short-term rentals and issued stay-at-home advisories through May 18th. Business really sort of gets going after Memorial Day out here on Nantucket, and certainly when schools traditionally close and into the summer. And the restaurant associations, the lodging associations in particular, are asking you know, what the restrictions are going to be when they're allowed to reopen and when might that happen. They're anticipating, you know, potential capacity reductions of almost 50% in some cases. They're anticipating business being down about 50% in some cases. And they really are just trying to put some plans together now to stay viable, to stay solvent, and to survive throughout this pandemic and beyond.
Right alongside of that, the retailers on the island put together a petition asking to be allowed to resume some business in some form. Tell us about that.
They're also hurting. Obviously, everyone seems to be hurting. And a petition started by Bess Clark of the houseware store Nantucket Looms and signed by 11 other island retailers is asking Governor Baker to allow curbside pickup from retail stores, much like it's allowed at restaurants around the state. The select board last week voted to endorse that petition, making the case that small business owners, retailers on Nantucket, need a better chance to make a profit, at least while the business closure remains in effect. You know, if those retail shops can't open, Clark said, customers are left to either shop online or forced to go off island to stores like Walmart and Target, which are allowed to be open because they have groceries. Clark and some other retailers have been selling online for the past 2 months, but have seen a real steep decline in sales. So in an unrelated move, a step toward what they're looking for, Baker did allow for home delivery, and they acknowledge that that's probably going to be the only compromise that might be allowed given the stay-at-home order, because it means that people don't have to leave their houses to get a little bit more, get those goods. But it's not enough in the eyes of some of these retailers who are really struggling during a downtime anyway on Nantucket. Mm-hmm. This is certainly not the busiest time of the year by far, but it does bring in some much-needed revenue, and it's obviously will start ticking up week by week and weekend by weekend in particular as we get closer to the start of summer.
And Josh, maybe a little bit of good news, though. It's been a number of days since the island has seen a new confirmed case there. What's the feeling about that?
The feeling is positive again. 4 straight days since the last positive case of coronavirus on Nantucket was confirmed. Nantucket, as most people know, went through about 3 weeks ago a period of 22 straight days without any cases. There's been 13 positive cases confirmed on the island, fortunately, but sadly, one death, as well as one person transported off island for advanced care. There are currently no patients in the hospital on Nantucket being treated for coronavirus. 8 of the patients who tested positive have recovered, and 4 are still in isolation. So Nantucket doing everything it can and then some to flatten the curve, probably, certainly one of the, doing the best job of many communities across the state and maybe even in the country in the number of positive cases given the number of tests that have been performed.
Josh Bowling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Imagine trying to navigate the pandemic here locally without being a native English speaker. Reporter Noah Asimo takes a closer look at that in the Vineyard Gazette, and he joins us now. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, tell us about this effort on the island to bridge the language gap around public health and why it's particularly important to these populations.
It's sort of a national narrative that the pandemic is hitting and has been hitting communities of color harder than other demographic groups, but particularly ones that are non-native English speaking members. You can imagine it's difficult enough to have sort of your life disrupted by, new laws, new regulations, new ferry schedules and all that, but to not maybe be able to, if you don't speak English, a lot of that information is published in English through, media outlets like the Vineyard Gazette or through information that the hospital puts out. And so it's particularly important to try and get that information to people and to do it in a way that they sort of are comfortable with as well. A lot of people who maybe are not native English speakers don't actually go to the hospital that much or are not really familiar with it. So trying to reach out to those communities is particularly important now, especially because a lot of the issue with the pandemic, it affects everyone. And one of the reasons these stay-at-home orders are in place is because they're looking for compliance sort of across the board.
Well, tell us about the effort now on the island to bridge that gap and to get the message out to people who aren't native English speakers.
Yeah, so some of the things the hospital has been doing is that they're reaching out to basically all of their community partners, Martha's Vineyard Community Services, the food pantry, the school district, to make sure that sort of information is disseminated through them. And they've developed these coronavirus care kits that include English English and Portuguese language materials. They have masks, they have thermometers, and the information in it is, how do you put on a mask? What do you do if you're feeling ill? Can you come to the hospital? And part of it is also explaining to people that, especially people who are immigrants on the island, that your status is not going to be questioned when you come to the hospital. And were you to test positive there, you do have to participate in the contact tracing program that boards of health across the state are doing. But that part of that is that information remains anonymous and confidential, somewhat similar to the way a census works, in that you are asked certain biographical questions, but your citizenship is not asked, and that information is not something that the government can then use. So I think making that clear to people and making it clear in their own native language is particularly important. In the hospital, actually, they have three Portuguese-speaking employees who have been translating materials. And even as far as sort of internal care goes, they've made changes. And there's sort of been some unanticipated benefits of things like telehealth, which is that you can have interpreter services that are directly integrated into your sort of virtual care visit. So they're trying to, they've sort of, you know, as a way to adapt to the virus, it's also meant that they've sort of made these new connections within the community, which was kind of cool to hear about.
So I just want to ask you about that, these new connections in the community. Do they see this going forward as kind of essentially changing the model of how they're approaching some of their communications, after a post-pandemic
I think so. And I think part of it was that a lot of these sort of community relationships were previously established, but that they would never had to sort of be kicked into gear the way they have been now. And now that they are, I think it's something that they hope to continue. I mean, working with sort of, they're having weekly calls with community partners. They had one with that had community services on it in the food pantry, and all these groups were sort of brought together that previously I don't think were coordinating. And I think moving forward, they do plan to coordinate. The other thing is that we don't really know when this is going to end. And I think that, you know, regardless of whether it does end in sort of a gradual or immediate way, now that the infrastructure is established, they definitely hope to continue it.
It is reporter Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
State lawmakers met virtually, but all together, this week for the first time since the coronavirus pandemic started. Meanwhile, Governor Baker is keeping a close eye on the number of COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths as businesses clamor to reopen. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dehan for a recap on these stories.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
Well, it was a bit of a fight, but the House was able to approve a motion to hold a full formal session, but they did it remotely this week. A first, a historic moment.
Yeah, this was the first time in, 400 or so years that the General Court has been in existence that they've held a formal vote without everybody being there in the chamber. Then you're right, there was a fight. There was a bit of a partisan breakdown. What had to happen here is in order to pass a borrowing bill that's pretty crucial to keeping the state budget balanced during this crisis, they needed to put rules forward on how to govern and how to administer this remote vote. The plan has them call in votes to House leaders, and the House leaders kind of tally that up in the chamber itself. There are about a dozen of them in the chamber this week. And then the votes would go through somewhat like normal. The problem was that the plan that Speaker DeLeo had put forward didn't sit well with Republicans for a variety of reasons. Talks actually broke down a couple of times over how often representatives would get to speak to their amendments in debate. So basically, Republicans had a problem with the limits on debate and the restrictions that DeLeo wanted to put in place for these remote sessions. DeLeo was arguing that, a lengthier debate is only going to put the people in the state house more at risk. So that's why they needed to keep it a little bit smoother. And Republicans blocked this package from going forward a few times. In the end, though, they did reach a compromise. That session was handled, and they ended up passing that borrowing bill unanimously. There was never any, disagreement over the bill at hand, though it was just over the rules on how to get there.
I want to talk a little bit more about the borrowing bill, but first, I think it's interesting in the fight to get the approval for remote voting that House Speaker Robert DeLeo had to threaten to actually bring people back to the state house physically to get the vote passed.
Right. Yeah, it was kind of a drastic move I'd never really seen DeLeo do before. Because any member can stop anything from going through in an informal session, as it is, Republicans were putting the brakes on this rules package. DeLeo threatened to have Democrats come back to formally pass the bill, meaning that he would get enough Democrats into the building to outnumber however many Republicans show up. Obviously, there are far more Democrats than Republicans in the state legislature, and he actually went so far as to have tape put down in the corridor outside the House chamber every 6 feet so that he could show that if they were to come back and outvote the Republicans, they could do so while maintaining social distance. And it was kind of a drastic move, and there was an email basically threatening to do just so before that compromise was hammered out.
And the borrowing bill itself that lawmakers voted on Wednesday, talk a little bit about that. That's to help kind of shore up the budget, which has just really been blown apart by this crisis.
Yeah, state revenues, tax revenues have been way, way down over the last month or so because of this crisis and all the economic shutdown. Another major piece of it is because the income tax filing deadline was moved from April to July, all of the money that was expected to come in April isn't there. So the state is essentially going to authorize this borrowing so that the governor can borrow as much as needed to balance the budget in the interim, with the expectation that those income taxes will come in July to fill in the gap there. So it's short-term borrowing, but it could be upwards of $3 billion just to get us through this crisis.
And I think it's interesting, too, that they haven't put a cap on it, that they're letting the governor borrow what he needs to.
Right. There's some flexibility built into this. That's how a lot of borrowing goes. You know, the legislature authorizes a certain amount, and then the executive branch is the one that kind of spends it from there. The legislature always will approve far more than is spent, especially when you have a Democratic, kind of more liberal legislature and a more conservative governor, as we do.
What about on the Senate side? Are they trying to vote remotely? Are they having some of the issues that we saw over the last week in the House?
It's a different situation in the Senate because there's only 40 members. You know, they all have pretty sizable offices in the building, and it's just easier to shuffle smaller numbers of senators in and out of the chamber to take a vote like this. So they're doing it in two stages. The first stage, in order to get this borrowing bill done as fast as they can, they're going to have senators in the building, if they feel comfortable with it, to come into the chamber and vote and then kind of leave or shuffle around in a bit in order just to get this one thing passed. Like I said, it passed the House unanimously. There isn't that much need for debate and conflict. So, you know, them kind of shuffling in just to say their name and vote yes and then leave isn't that big a deal. The second phase is how they're going to handle the rest of the time, and that includes the state budget, you know, while we're in lockdown. So the Senate will be putting forward their own remote voting plan. They expect that by the end of the month so that they can start taking up major things in June.
I want to switch now to news from the governor. You know, he's really watching the number of COVID-19 cases, deaths, hospitalizations, all those different metrics as he looks toward May 18th, when the stay-at-home order is supposedly going to be lifted. Earlier this week, he was cautiously optimistic, but we did see cases rise again on Wednesday, so we really don't know if we'll be ready yet.
Exactly. The governor's really sticking to health officials' guidelines, and they say that it would require 2 weeks of consistent declining infections before the end or the downturn in social distancing and all the precautions that we're taking. And of course, that includes businesses being closed. Baker has extended the shutdown order to May 18th. That's the last day of the order, but he's certainly open to extending it further if that becomes necessary. Also on May 18th is when his task force for business reopenings is going to file their major report. Baker said they've actually filed interim reports and smaller bits of guidance here and there, and they have altered what stores can be open, you know, what businesses are essential or non-essential on a daily basis.
Like florists to open for Mother's Day, right?
Exactly. A florist and some retail stores are allowed to do more online. So people, you know, the stores won't be open, but employees would be able to go to the stores so that those retail shops could then sell online. So those are the small incremental changes that are being made. But we're not going to see the grand plan probably until May 18th, unless we do see a precipitous decline in infection rates that satisfies that two-week standard that Baker has adhered to. I would imagine that these business shutdown orders could extend further on into May, past the 18th.
And that is WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking to us from Boston, as he does most weeks. Mike, have a great weekend. Thanks.
You too. Bye-bye.
And that is WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean there. You're listening to the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. This week, Cape Cod Community College announced it is overhauling its summer and fall class format in response to the coronavirus pandemic. WCAI's Eve Zuckoff reported how the college will determine who gets to go back into the classroom, and she joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, you spoke with 4C's President John Cox about this. Tell us, what's the plan here, according to him?
Right. So they're describing it as a distance learning format. So about half of all classes will be exclusively online. Some will have scheduled meeting times through video conferencing like Zoom. And then the other half, that's what's kind of interesting, that'll be the hybrid approach. So mostly online classes, but some occasional and socially distant in-person meetings. And that's for only things like science labs, for example, or studio arts, really.
So that's a lot of classes online for everybody, no matter what. Financially, how does this affect the students, and how is the college doing in general?
Yeah, so 4C's President John Cox said the new learning format definitely won't lead to lower fees for the school's 3,000 or so students this fall, but that's because he says he's confident that their education won't suffer. And then more generally, Cox does see a financial challenge ahead when it comes to really securing public funds, you know, just given what we expect to be strains on the state budget. But there have been no layoffs yet, according to school officials. And while summer enrollment is down, they're actually hoping they may see more students try to enroll this fall who are looking for lower cost courses that can be transferred, given all kinds of financial strain on families and individuals.
Hey, in non-coronavirus news, you reported on a new partnership between environmentalists and housing advocates here on the Cape. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was really nice to report on a solutions story this week. This is basically two local nonprofits, the Association to Preserve Cape Cod and Housing Assistance Corporation. They're working together to find new places to put affordable housing on the Cape without putting more burden on the environment. And so what they're really doing is this kind of interesting approach. They're starting with a blank map of the Cape and then adding data layers. So where are the town centers where jobs are? Where are drinking water supplies? Supplies that you don't want to put housing? Where are critical habitats? And then most importantly, where are their sewers? Because sewers allow for more low-cost housing density in a more eco-friendly way than septic systems, for example. And once they layer on all of those different factors onto this blank map, they'll be able to go to towns over the next 2 years and say, look, we think as environmentalists and housing advocates, there's good reason to think that a new Habitat for Humanity home or affordable housing unit or apartments would be really good here, because they want to put a dent in the Cape's housing crisis.
And this is would be a way to sidestep some of the acrimony that comes about when some of these projects are first projected.
That's right. There are a number of cases where, you know, neighbors hear that Habitat for Humanity houses are going into their neighborhood, we heard, and they fight it for some reasons that are, you know, very important to them in all cases. But it often leaves housing advocates and environmentalists frustrated, because they watch as land gets developed on the Cape and open space dwindles, and then they both lose because they're not really working together to make sure that there are priority spaces that they're agreeing on and can unite behind together.
Mm-hmm. WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you.
That is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from WCAI's Sam Houghton, Jeanette Barnes, and Eve Zuckoff there. We spoke with Rich Salzberg at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner. We heard from Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford, and Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer in Mirror, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, and Mike Dean up at the State House. Big thanks to Dan Treidel back at the studio. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.